Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. Our speaker is Greg P. from Alcoholics in Action in New Haven, Connecticut. Hi, I'm Greg Plagas, alcoholic. I'll be right back. All right. Wow, I'm so nervous tonight. I didn't think we were going to make it tonight. Thanks, Michael and Mike, for taking the drive with me. So, wow. You know, this is kind of cool. Hopefully I'm going to fall asleep. Or anyone else. You'll probably fall asleep before I do. I apologize. I'm not that exciting of a speaker. This is not one of my least favorite things to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, but when I'm asked to do it, I do it. What I really like doing in Alcoholics Anonymous today is sitting down with another alcoholic and just sharing my experience. It's one of the greatest things that has given my life a sense of purpose today, a sense of meaning and some direction. And it's cool. It's the greatest show on earth. And, me and two other guys drove down here, and literally it took us an hour to get out of New Haven. It's crazy. I mean, and there was no traffic. It was just, it took us an hour, and our phones were ringing, and we were about to get on the highway, and it rang, and we picked it up, and we had to take a U-turn, go back, and pick up Mike, and we got on the highway again. So we had a little bit of a journey. My sponsor gives me some simple directions. I do it. I see today probably one of the reasons why he does it is so I can ramble for just a couple minutes and hopefully God kicks in and I shut down, hopefully. So if there's any problems at the end of the meeting, it's all him. It's not me. I'm sorry. I don't take any credit. Works. I'm probably going to drink a lot of water tonight, which is a bad thing. I haven't gone to the bathroom in 3 hours. My stomach's killing me. I've had some McDonald's, and that's about it. So my home group's the Alcoholics in Action group. I'd like to share. Thanks. It is good to see you again. We meet on Sunday nights in New Haven, Connecticut. It's a one-hour speaker meeting, much like this group. I love being a part of my home group today. It's really cool. You know, it's on a Sunday night. I know it's a place that I can go and I can hear a message of hope. You know, I know that I can bring one of my new guys or girls with me and, you know, we can get to that meeting. And I know that sitting next to them that they're going to hear some hope, which is important, you know. And I know as being a part of that group that throughout the week that there's other members who are being active in Alcoholics Anonymous and going out and going to some local detoxes and shelters and rehabs and for a guy like me, I need to be doing stuff like that. I need to be active. I need to be in the trenches. You know, it's the thing that kind of keeps me, it keeps it green for me, you know, because of myself, I'll forget stuff like that, you know. And the sponsor that I have today, that's where I met him. And I met his sponsor, my grand sponsor, when I was sitting at a rehab in 2001 in New Haven, Connecticut. And they came in, they came in every Thursday night. And they shared the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. They shared the message of those 12 steps. Our 12 steps. You know, they shared the message of one alcoholic sitting down with another alcoholic. For free and for fun. And I absolutely hated them. And I hated them for a while. And when that rehab started to let me go out to meetings and stuff. You know, they would say their first and last name. And they wore these shirts and ties and I always talked about the big book and the steps and sponsorship and God. And I'm like, what is with this book? I mean, seriously, like, you know, I want to know about how to get my life back. How am I going to learn that out of some book in these 12 steps? I can't stop drinking and doing some other stuff. I just couldn't understand it. And, you know, I hated these guys for a while. And they ended up being some of my closest friends today. And one of them is my sponsor, my grand sponsor. And, you know, without some of those guys and girls, I don't think I'd be here today. My sobriety date is August 15, 2001. I already said my home group. I do have a sponsor, which I talked about a little bit, and I am a sponsor today. You know, this last time around for me, this is my second time trying to get sober. This last time around for me is has been pretty crazy. You know, I stepped out of a hospital in New Haven St. Raphael's Hospital. We pretty much have two hospitals in New Haven. One's Yale, not Yale University, but Yale New Haven Hospital and St. Raphael's. You know, New Haven's a pretty wild city. I don't know why, but some people call it Pistol Wave in New Haven. And, I mean, literally, if you go to the emergency room, if you don't have an axe coming out of your head, like, you're waiting 3 hours to see someone. And on August 15, 2001, my grandmother and my mother brought me into the other big hospital, St. Raphael's, which is pretty much the same way. Excuse me. And, you know, they brought me in there for drinking and other stuff, and you know, I sat in the waiting room for a little bit, and I finally did an intake, and next thing I know, 3 days later, I'm leaving and I'm going into a treatment center, which is pretty wild, you know. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me even to this day, because I try to bring guys and girls to that same hospital that I went to, and they're lucky if they get to stay a night. I mean, it's such a wild place, and there's so many people coming in and out that, you know, I look back at my experience and I don't understand how they let me stay there for those 3 days. You know, and I don't know, what if they let me out that next day and I didn't stay those 3 days? I don't know if I would be here today. You know, so, you know, I look back at my life and I see a lot of things, and I can call it coincidence, or, you know, I can look back and I can just see that the hand of God was in my life, you know, even without me knowing it, even without me asking for it, it was there. You know, and I left that place and I got into a rehab, and I stayed in that rehab for 3 months. And then after that rehab, they sent me into a sober house. And I stayed in that sober house for a year. And I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. My first time around, I think I probably went to one meeting. I really wasn't introduced much to it. But this time, like I said, there were people coming into this rehab, and they were bringing the message home. They were talking about the steps. They were talking about the big book. And, you know, I left and I started to go to attend these meetings on a pretty regular basis. And, you know, I had some stuff that was kind of pushing me. Motivating me. By the time I was 19 years old, I was 20 at this time. When I was 19, I got arrested for underage drinking, reckless driving, and DWI. This is just my experience. It's not the experience of everyone I know today. This doesn't make me an alcoholic, but it's something that alcoholism brought about in my life. And I also got arrested for possession of crack cocaine and a deadly weapon. I mean, alcohol took on many forms for me. You know, whatever you had, I was doing. You know, I preferred certain things, but if I couldn't get my hand on those, I was doing whatever you had, you know, because I see today it wasn't about the drink and it wasn't about the other stuff for me. You know, it was just getting outside of me. And that seemed to be my whole problem my whole life, was me. You know, I just never could see it. You know, I was so delusional. You know, from day one, I really couldn't tell the truth from the false. You know, my whole life, you know, growing up as a kid, I mean, I'm just always all over the place. If you can follow with me, God bless you. You know, growing up as a kid, I can remember, you know, I was just always that shy, kind of nervous, kind of introverted. I mean, I was just always so to myself, which is weird because I grew up in this huge family that loves talking. I mean, you know, my parents got divorced at a young age, so I lived with my mother and her mother and her stepfather. And then I had a younger sister and a younger brother. And, you know, growing up, they were just really short and really loud Italians. And that's just who they were. You know, and when people would come over, they were like, you know, why does your family always yelling at you and yelling at each other? I'm like, they're not. They're talking. You should see when they yell. It's insane. I go lock myself in the room. And so at a young age, like, I would sit down at the dinner table and I would look around. And sometimes I would say to myself, like, man, like, this is insane. Like, I swear, you know, are they lying to me? I must be adopted. Like, I am not like them. Sitting at my own dinner table, feeling different than my own family. You know, and that's my experience as a young kid. You know, and I didn't realize how much I suffered. I didn't realize how miserable I was until I was 15 years old. You know, and I took a drink. And I felt relief. You know, and I look back today and I say, you know, I didn't even realize it. You know, and I think that happens to a lot of us with a lot of things. You know, I didn't realize how much I was suffering until I wasn't suffering anymore. You know, and it was the same way in Alcoholics Anonymous for me. You know, for a while in Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't realize that I was suffering until I wasn't suffering anymore. How much I was suffering. You know, and I picked up that drink at 15 years old and it just got insane. You know, like I said, by the time I was 19 years old, I was already getting arrested, you know. And my parents were divorced, and like I said, I moved in with my mom and my grandmother and my step-grandfather and my little sister and my little brother. My mom and my dad got married real young. They had two kids by the time they were 23. I'm 29 years old. I can barely take care of myself. You know, my mom was a single parent taking care of two kids. And for the longest time, I resented her. Because for the longest time, I felt like she didn't love me. And for the longest time, I felt like she was out living her life. Until today that I had a sponsor that took me through these 12 steps. And I took a fourth and I did a fourth step. And I sat and I did a fifth step and he showed me what my part was. And all of a sudden, my perception on things started to change. And I had an opportunity to make amends. One of the greatest amends that I made was to my family, especially my mother. You know, that for so long I had so much anger built up and so much resentment and so much hatred towards this woman. One, for, you know, not allowing me to have a father. And two, for not loving me and not being around. But what I realized today is that at 23 years old, you know, she no longer lived her life. She was living her life for her two kids. But I couldn't see that because I am so self-centered. I am so stuck in myself. And that's always been my problem, like I said before. I have always been my problem. And it's caused me to suffer. Suffer for a long time until I was about 15 years old. You know? I mean, I don't know. For 15 years, I guess it felt like I was holding my breath and I didn't even know it until I took that drink and it felt like I could just finally breathe. You know, and here is this poor woman, but at the time I didn't see it that way. You know, she's out there, you know, she had no career. She married my father. My father was going to take over the family business. And she was just going to live her life and raise two kids and not have to worry about anything. You know, I mean, raising two kids alone is something to worry about. It's a full-time job in itself, you know, but that didn't have it. That didn't happen. That wasn't in the plans for those two. You know, and they had to end up splitting. So my mom didn't know what to do. So she decided to do something that she did a little bit of and tried to get really good at. And she started cutting hair. But in Connecticut, the amount of money that she wanted to make so that she can provide for us two and get out of this environment that we're in and start our own family, she realized she had to go down to New York City. So every morning, this woman would wake up probably at like 3-4 in the morning to get on a train to travel 2 hours on a train to New York City. To cut hair, to make the money that she wanted to work probably 8-10 hours, to take a train all the way back. You know, and I hated this woman for so long. I resented her for so long because I felt she didn't love me because she wasn't around. And she pawned me off to my grandmother and grandfather. You know, but a positive thing out of that was me and my grandmother formed this amazing connection. And she is the absolute love of my life. And I hope you're not recording this, and I hope my mother and my fiance don't hear this. But she is the absolute love of my life. I mean, this woman owns about 98% of my heart. You know, and the other two, divided out. I love this woman. She is so amazing. She taught me so much. I mean, my life growing up, I give credit to my teachers and the psychiatrists and the counselors and all the people that I had to talk to as a little kid. And but man, I've learned the most about life and about principles. And, you know, and my grandmother was talking to me the same stuff that you guys are talking to me about. And her Cadillac, just driving me around town. You know, that's really how I learned about life. And literally, if there was one person that I would have to lay down my life for right now, just so they can live one more day, I swear to God, it would be my grandmother. I love this woman. And at this time, by this second rehab that I'm in, before I got into there and before her and my mother found me out in Bethany, Connecticut and dragged me to that hospital, I was consumed. My life was drinking. My life was drinking. And you know, sometimes I don't even like sharing this because sometimes it just—I mean, it's so insane. I mean, it's so insane where, I mean, the price that I was willing to pay for that drink, you know, I just—I couldn't do that. This thing that we call sobriety, I mean, you know, I think about it today. My first sobriety date should be October 2nd, 1980. That's my birthday. And for 15 years, I tried staying sober. And it didn't work too well. So there's this night I'm drinking, and it's one of those nights where the alcohol is gone, and I have no money, and the other substances are gone, but I'm just not done. You know, that phenomenon of craving has me in its grips, and I just can't stop. And I need more. And I look to my friend Ken, and I say, I know exactly where we can go. And I thought of my grandmother, because she's that woman. You know what I mean? No matter what, no matter how far down you know, you've gone, no matter how bad off you are, what situation you're in, she's going to help you. She's just an amazing woman, and I knew that I could take advantage of her. So I pull up to that house, and you know, after a night of drinking and doing some other stuff, I remember we pulled up to in front of her house, and my friend Ken looks at me, and if you haven't noticed already, you will in a little bit, that I have a little bit of an ego. And he looks at me and he's like, "Dude, I don't know, you look a little off tonight." I'm like, "Dude," you know, I'm thinking in my head, "Who the f- do you think you are? I am fine, man. Who are you to tell me that?" Yeah, I'm thinking this in my head. I don't really say it to him. It's a little bit bigger than I am. I think I said some other choice words, and you know, I open the door and I shut it and I start walking. Now, my grandmother's neighborhood is as dark as this neighborhood is. It's not like this neighborhood, but it's as dark as this neighborhood is. And it's probably like 10 o'clock at night. My grandmother is probably about half hour into her sleep already right now. 8:30, yeah, she's been sleeping for a half hour already. And she gets up at 5. I don't know how she does it. She's amazing. You know, and I remember getting up to her door and I'm knocking on her door. And, you know, she has one of those houses that I remember was such a pain in the butt when I was a little kid to try to sneak around. It doesn't creak when you step on it, but once you step off of it, it creaks. So I remember hearing the creaks for her to get out of bed, you know, and walking so slow. You know, she's been sleeping for a while. She finally gets to the door. And I remember she opens that door and she just takes one look at me and she just starts crying. You know, and I could see the tears starting to come down her eyes and, you know, kind of that, like, that where her jaw is shaking a little bit. And I can barely, like, even look at her, you know, and she's just like, "Gregory, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're killing yourself. You're killing yourself. And you're killing us, too." I love this woman. I love this woman with all my heart. I'm willing to pay any price. I mean, it robbed me from everything. I shouldn't say it robbed me. I gave it away. You know? And crazy. This is how crazy it is. The only thing that's going on in my head is, when is this old lady just going to shut up? Just shut up. Either give me the money or don't. Don't give me this line. But of course, again, I didn't say that. I was thinking it. You know? And she did. She walked back to her room, got some money, and gave it to me. I told her I was taking some girl out on a date. I felt embarrassed that I didn't have money to, you know, take her out to the diner and maybe go to a movie later. She knows what's going on. I'm still, to her face, lying to her. You know? And I left her house, and I did what we do, and once again, I'm out of money, I'm out of booze, and I'm out of other stuff, and I'm just not done. My grandma's an old school Italian woman. I love her. And like when I would drive around in her Cadillac and she'd turn over and talk to me and I'd be like, "Grandma, back on the road," because she'd be on someone's front yard. And she'd get back on the road and like she's so cool. Like she literally shops by, like she would get like, I don't know what supermarkets you guys have. We have Stop and Shop, ShopRite, like 6 different supermarkets. But she'd go, one supermarket for meat, one for vegetables, one for this place always has dented cans, so they're cheaper, so we go there for that. You know, it's like, and it was the same with, like, she'd drop money off at Bank of America. She'd have a bank account and Citizens Bank and this bank. And, you know, but I was her little Gregory. She opened her life to me, her heart to me, everything to me. She never held back one thing. And she always told me, "If you're ever in need, you always come to me. And if you can't come to me, I'll show you where stuff is." She showed me the envelope of money she has in her fur coat in her closet. I knew about the envelope of money under her bed, behind her dresser. You know, everything in her house has plastic and it has some sort of cover on it too. Like the dining room table is a table. And then it has not a foam cover, but some type of cover. I don't know what it is. Then it has the plastic over it. And I know the table, the envelope of money, and then the cover, and then the plastic. And so I went back to her house that night, probably 2 in the morning. I snuck in through a window, which I always used to sneak in when I used to live there when I was a young kid. And I looked at my grandmother. I'm standing over her, and I reached under and I grabbed that envelope. You know, I went to her dresser and I went to that fur coat. And never is there a thought of, Gregory, what are you doing? This is insane. Not one. You know, I can't think about you. I'm always so consumed with myself. You know, alcoholism, selfish and self-centered. Thank God this is not a selfish program. Thank God this is a help others program. You know, man, but that next day, you know what I'm talking about. That next day, I can't talk about the guilt and the shame and the remorse. And at this point in my life, at 19 years old, I want to put a gun in my mouth. Who am I? I can't look in the mirror. I can't tell you what color your hair or your eyes are, but I'll tell you what shoes you're wearing. I mean, I was doing those types of actions. That's the life I had to live. And I was just pathetic. Pathetic. In 4 years. I mean, such a short amount of time. So progressive for me. You know? And you know, I ended up in this house in Bethany, Connecticut, and my mom and my grandmother never gave up on me. They are my saving grace. And they pulled me out of that house and they sent me to that hospital. I don't know. I don't know if my grandma maybe slipped them 100 or something, or my mom, you know, begged them. Or I don't know if they just took a look at me and after they got my blood result to see what was in my system, they felt sorry for me. And they gave me that bed for 3 days. I mean, you know, those things are like gold. An ER bed in New Haven is like gold. I mean, like, they could probably sell on the black market, you know, like you want a couple hours, thousand. I mean, I don't know. It's so crazy. And I am so stuck in my old ideas, though, because I left that hospital. I left that rehab. I got into that sober house. And I got the heat of Springfield, Massachusetts on me, probation. And I got the heat of New Haven, Connecticut on me. These two different arrests. And that was my motivation. And I wasn't hearing it, but I don't know why, but I figured if I just wasn't drinking, wasn't doing the other stuff, I was going to your meetings, and I was trying to manage my life and put things back together, I'll just be all right, because drinking, it must be my problem. This stuff must be my problem. So if I just stop, I'll be good, and I'll just try to get my life back together. And that's what I proceeded to do. And those two guys that would come to that rehab, I asked one of them to be my sponsor, because I'm like, they look like they were like, I thought they were like the AA presidents or something. I'm like, really, who wears a shirt and tie to an AA meeting? You know, that's like, who says their first and last name? It just didn't make sense. I mean, and this kid, you know, I'm like, God, every meeting I would go to, they're either speaking at it or sharing it or, you know, they're, you know, and it, this guy, every time he would read, he was read with such enthusiasm and excitement. I'm like, what is this kid taking, some Xanax or Klonopins on the side? I mean, this dude's got some great medication. I mean, like, give me some of that stuff, man. It's just, I'm like, how do you have that? What do you, dude, something's going on here that you're not telling me about, you know? And I'm like, all right, well, if I ask him, and I tell people he's my sponsor, no one's going to question what I'm doing. So that's what I did. I asked him to be my sponsor. And that's as far as we went. That night, in front of the Friday Night Pacific Group in New Haven, I asked this guy to be my sponsor. And that was our relationship that night, that 2-minute conversation. You know, and I proceeded to not drink and go to meetings on a regular basis, go to my DWI courses, go back to this treatment center to give urines, to send to my probation officer, have my sober house person sign court letters for both probation officers. And I figured if I could just get my life back together, I'll be okay. I'll put this behind me and everything will be all right. And I proceeded to do that. And my motivation was that I knew I wasn't going to do the whole jail thing pretty well, so this whole drinking thing is completely out of the question, you know? And things went well for a little while, and then all of a sudden, I don't know, you know, it just, I'd be waking up or I'd be sitting in my sober house, and I got the job back. DWI courses were done. I can get my license back now. I got a car. This year was almost coming up. I'd be clear from Springfield. No more urines, no more letters, no more probation. You know, I'm going to be a free man. And all of a sudden, you know, probably about 6 months into this, I start thinking this stuff in my head, you know. And these thoughts start coming in my head like, man, you're going to be free. No one's really going to know if you take one drink. I mean, it's just alcohol. It's a liquid. It's like water, but it's colored. It's not that bad. You know? And I just started to get really uncomfortable with this. And I got this job. I became a union carpenter. And I'm working third shift. And when I'm at the job, I'm feeling great. You know, they gave me this position and they were teaching me things and I felt a part of, and a lot of the same principles we do here, kind of like I was applying there and I didn't even realize it, and I was feeling okay when I'm doing that. And then I would stop doing that and I'd go home and everyone else would be at work and I'm stuck at this sober house, and I just couldn't stand being with myself anymore. I was just feeling so restless, so irritable and so discontent, and I'm like, what is going on? You know, I'm going to meetings on a regular basis. I mean, I got a car now. I was in a relationship. I'm starting to talk to my family a little bit. I mean, things are working out. I'm not drinking. I'm not doing the other stuff. You know, I'm doing the urines. I'm sending the letters. I'm doing everything you're asking. Why am I feeling like this? Why am I looking around in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and everyone else seems like they got this thing and I don't, you know? And there was this one thing my whole life, you know, for some reason I was so scared of what you thought about me. You know, and like I talked about, as I was a young kid, those feelings, you know, those feelings of insecurity and feeling not a part of, feeling kind of disconnected. Like, I was so afraid to tell people about this stuff. And thank God at 15 years old, I found a solution. I didn't have to tell you anymore because I had a solution to it. And here, all of a sudden, at 22 years old, here I am faced with that same problem, but I can't go back to that solution anymore. You took that from me. The state of Massachusetts took that from me, and the state of Connecticut took it from me. In order for me not to go to jail, I can't drink and do other stuff, you know. And the rest of my time of that year, my sobriety got very, very dark. It became work, go home, take some Tylenol PM or something, and fall asleep as quickly as possible because my head and my heart were a scary place. And at the end of that year, I'm done with all that stuff, and I'm sitting in my sober house room, and I'm looking at my life, and I'm saying I don't want to drink, because I know that drink's going to lead to something else, and it's going to, I just don't want that life. And I'm looking at my year of sobriety at 22 years old. I'm saying 22 years old, 1 year sober, and I have to fight this fight for God knows how long. I don't know if I can do this, you know. And I'm looking at this life, and you know, I see today it talks about that in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous as our jumping off point. And I didn't know what to do. And I was figuring probably suicide would be the best thing. Because I don't want to drink, but I do want to drink. I want to stay sober, but I don't want to stay sober. Not if it's going to be like this. And I really don't want to pay the price of drinking, but I don't know another solution. I'm trying the sobriety solution, but it ain't working too well. And the grace of God. You know, I'm sitting in this room and a thought not of my own enters my mind. And I know it's not a thought of my own because those last 6 months of that year were dark and there were not thoughts like this in my mind. And it pretty much said, Greg, you got to do something. If you don't take some action with your life, you are going to die. And there was a part of me that really didn't want to die. I mean, obviously, I'm standing here tonight. And he says, why don't you call someone and be honest for the first time in your life and tell them how you feel? And I called this guy Chris. And let me tell you, in that first year, besides that talk we had in front of that meeting, I was supposed to meet with him one time at a Starbucks in New Haven on Chapel Street, on the campus of Yale University. And I remember I was driving to go meet this girl I was dating at the time at Southern Connecticut State University, where our home group is now. And my phone rings and I pick it up. And he's like, hey man, are you okay? I'm like, who is this? He's like, it's Chris, your sponsor. I'm like, oh, hey, what's going on, man? He's like, I've been waiting here for like an hour and a half. You know, I thought maybe something happened to you. I'm like, oh, dude, I totally forgot, man. I'm so sorry. You know, I'm going to meet someone. I'll talk to you later. Bye, click. You know? And so I was nervous to call him, this guy, because I knew he would probably just hang up on me. And I called him. And he didn't hang up. He'd ask me how I was doing. And I all just, man, I just started unleashing on this guy. I just, you know, blabbing to him like I did with you, except I don't have tears tonight. Like, I had tears on the phone that day. And I'm like, dude, I'm so scared. I don't know what is going on, man. I think I'm going nuts. I don't know if I want to kill myself or take a drink or what, man. What is wrong with me? Do I need some outside help or something? Like, please just tell me. You know? And he says, well, in my opinion, it sounds like you're just suffering from untreated alcoholism. He says, what I know that there's two solutions to that. I'm not saying that there are two solutions for you, but, you know, he says, the first solution that I know of is drinking. Did drinking work for you? I said, hell yeah, it did, man. He says, all right. Did you pay a price for it? I said, hell yeah, I did. That's why I'm here. He says, are you willing to pay that price again? I said, you know what? Maybe I am. He says, that's okay. I've been there. He says, the other solution that I know of is these 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that are laid out in our big book. Have you ever tried them? I said, no, I haven't. He says, all right. So let me ask you. You've been in a 12-step fellowship for a year, and you didn't try the 12 steps? I said, no. He said, all right. It's all right. He said, can you live with yourself knowing that there's possibly, I'm not saying it is, but there's possibly a solution to your drinking and all other problems, and you never gave it a shot? Can you live with yourself knowing that possibly there's a solution to your problems and you never gave it a shot? Bless you. I hung up that phone and I knew that I wouldn't be able to live with that, so I went over to that guy's house. And in 3 hours, I'm on my knees saying a prayer out of this book with him, holding his hand. I didn't know what the hell was going to happen that day. You know, somehow in that sober house room, I said a little prayer, just please help me. I picked up that phone and someone was on the other line with a solution. You know, and in a couple hours, I'm on my knees saying a prayer that I don't even know what the heck I was saying. We were just reading something out of a book. And he says, this decision that we have just made together right now, if it's going to have any depth, if it's going to have any weight, if it's going to mean anything, you got to take some action. I said, all right. So he handed me a piece of paper and a pen, and I started writing this stuff down that he told me to write. And then I'm sitting down reading this stuff to him. And, you know, there was some stuff that I was scared to put down on that paper, and as I'm reading this stuff to him, we're done. He says, all right, well, is there anything else? And I said, yeah, there is. And I start sharing some stuff with him that I swear I thought I'd never tell anyone. Of that last run before my mom and my grandmother picked me up in Bethany, Connecticut, there was some stuff I was doing on the streets of New Haven that I thought I'd never do. Some stuff I was doing for that drink and those other things that, you know, what we do when we're out on the street. Stuff that I'm not going to share exactly from a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous, but you got the picture. I mean, yeah, I was doing that too. I mean, I would wake up in the morning, I could not wash off the guilt and the shame and the disgust, and just waking up wanting to put a gun in my mouth. But then yet, I would do it once again the next day. And I'm sharing this stuff with this guy, so scared, you know? And he looks at me, and he doesn't laugh, and he just kind of smiles a little bit, and he says, you know what? And he starts sharing some stuff that he shared with his sponsor. And for the first time in my life, I felt this a part of feeling. That I wasn't less than you or I wasn't more than you. I was just right here with you. I felt a part of, not apart from. I felt a connection. And he says, do you want to go home or you want to do this here? There's some more direction we need to take. I said, I guess I'll stay here. And he says, I want you to sit alone quietly for 1 hour and think about the stuff that we've done today. And read over these first five proposals, these first five steps that you've just done. And ask yourself if you've done to the best of your ability, if you've left anything out. And if you feel you're ready to move on, you know, I want you to take a look at steps 6 and 7. And I want you to ask God to remove this stuff that is blocking you from Him. And after that hour, I did that. And I am so nervous and anxious. And so, I mean, it was like, literally, it'd be like 10 minutes and I'd have to walk around his house. Another 10 minutes, I'd walk around. I remember I'm looking in his fridge. I'm like, does he have alcohol in here? I'm looking through his cabinets and stuff. I'm in his bathroom, in his medicine cabinet, seeing if he's got like pills or something. I was convinced he was taking something. And but he wasn't, and I finally sat down and, you know, I'm finishing it, and he was still gone. He said a little bit more than an hour, and I remember I opened up that book and I did this stuff, and you know, I got on my knees and I read this stuff out of this book that he told me to read, the 7-step prayer. But I remember in my heart what I was feeling was like, God, please just help me. If this is it, I'll just keep doing it. And if I need to be the poster child for AA, I will be the poster child for AA. And I remember I got up off my knees after saying that prayer, and my life has never been the same since. 7 years later. You know, and I haven't looked back from that day. And he finally came back, and we made a list of all these amends I needed to make, and he sent me out to make these amends. And then I met with him next week, and we talked about steps 10, 11, and 12. He sent me out to start sponsoring other people. And I said, Chris, you know, I got a year sober, but I've only been doing this with you for just a short amount of time. I don't have anything to offer these people. What am I going to say? I'm going to kill them. You know? And he says, that's all right. I don't care how you feel or what you're thinking. I just want your feet to do the action. He says, you show up and God will do the work. And I left that conversation with him, and I had this guy that I was, this friend of mine, I dropped him off at this rehab Grant Street that I was at. And as I was leaving, almost about to leave that place, I remember this guy, you know, comes running up. He's like, hey, I saw you in the meeting. Do you sponsor people? I said, yeah, as of like an hour ago, I do. And that started my journey with working with other alcoholics, you know, and that's been the absolute highlight of my life, sitting down with another drunk, one-on-one, sharing my experience. And that's all I have to share today is my experience. And I started to look back at all that stuff that I was filled with so much guilt and shame and remorse for. And I realized that's my greatest tool. That's my greatest asset today. To identify with another alcoholic. To win their hope. To hopefully motivate them just a little bit to take this action. This action that they probably don't believe in like I didn't. This action they probably don't understand. Or can comprehend, which I couldn't of any of that stuff either. But just to take this action. As long as we take this action, we get the result. That's what my experience has been. I don't understand this whole business, these 12 steps, this God thing, this spirituality. I don't understand it. I can't comprehend it. I can't. I just know that as long as I take this action, I can't deny the presence of something greater than myself and my light living in my heart. You know? I feel it's something I've been born with. I feel we're all born with this thing. You know? And somewhere along the line, I've allowed this stuff to come into my life that kind of blocks me from it. That I'm never separated from it, but I'm kind of blocked off from it. And that's kind of what these 12 steps have been for me today. A pathway that removes the stuff that blocks me from God. You know? So I can experience the life awake today, the way I was intended to experience it. Just the same way that I see little babies experiencing it when I get to hold them in my arms. My family loves making babies. Let me tell you, my grandmother has like great-great-grandchildren. And time is like 30. I don't know. It's my cousin John. He's going for the record in the family. He's got 13 girls right now. Yeah. So I've been around little babies my whole life, and I don't understand it. I can't define it. I just don't know. But there's something that I feel in my heart when I look in these little babies' eyes, man. It just fills me up. Like I look in their eyes, and I don't see fear or resentment or guilt or shame or hatred or just none of that stuff. I just see joy. Like I see a light on in their eyes. you know, and a presence in their face, you know, it's awesome. To me, I think we're all intended to live life like that, free. That's what I see. I see freedom, you know. Somewhere along the lines, I've got blocked off from that freedom, you know. And that's what I believe alcoholism to be. Just this yearning for God, man. It's this spiritual malady, this hole in my soul. And I was trying to fill it with whatever I could. I didn't know, however young, that I was seeking God, that what I was suffering was from a hole in the soul. But all I know is when I found certain powers, man, I thought they filled it. I thought that's what I'd been looking for, and that's how I felt at 15 years old. I didn't realize how much I was suffering until I wasn't suffering anymore. I didn't truly realize how much I was suffering until this guy showed me this path. This guy took my hand gently and put my hand into the hand of God. And he says, your job now is just to keep one hand open and one hand into the hand of God. And with that open hand, you just grab that man or that woman who is drowning. And you take their hand and you put their hand into the hand of God. And that's what this deal is about today. You know, my sponsor is my best friend, you know. And he showed me who my real sponsor is today. You know, and it's an amazing thing. But sometimes I get a little wayward. And I realize that I need that human contact today. And he's still very much a big part of my life today. You know, and when I get a little too stuck in self, he kind of bumps me back right in the direction. And man, I feel like I'm just starting to unwind finally. So I just want to thank Jeff for asking me to come up. And we really appreciate, you know, you coming down to New Haven for us and everyone else who has traveled down. And, you know, it's really amazing. It's, you know, I'm doing this thing in New Haven and I'm on fire with it. I'm enthusiastic about it. And I found a thing I'm passionate about today, man, that absolutely fills my heart. And I got a friend, Jack McNamara, who's from Massachusetts, and he came down here to go to school. And his experience is much like my experience. And he was suffering for a year at school. And, you know, he found our group and he got connected with a sponsor and he's doing this deal. And then school's over and he goes back to break and he goes up to Massachusetts and he's looking around for these people who are doing the deal like we're doing the deal. And he finds these people up in Boston and Dorchester, you know, which I'm pretty sure some of them have come down to speak here, you know. And then we meet these people up in Boston. Then we meet these people up in Pennsylvania. And my eyes have opened that, wow, this thing is all over the place. You know, it's not just in New Haven, Connecticut. There's these pockets of enthusiasm that are all over the place, and I love being a part of it today. I love going and traveling and meeting new people, you know. So we're definitely going to hang out for a little bit. I might have to hit the bathroom real quick, but I'll be around for a little bit. I'm going to talk to everyone and get some phone numbers and to meet some new friends. And, you know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous today. I absolutely love it. Wow, that is crazy for me to be saying that. I am happy to be sober today. Hey, amen. Cool. Yeah. It's awesome. You know, I feel alive today. You know, this weekend we're having our group host the New Haven Spring Conference. And got some flyers in my car and it passed out. It's going to be a great weekend. Yeah, what was that little like promotion thing, I guess, huh? But, you know, and the name of the conference is Alive Again. You know? And one of my favorite parts in the big book about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm a little blind, so I think I'm about out of time, is the part in the third step. We were reborn. And I'm not much of a religious man, but I love those words. We were reborn. And that's what I feel. I feel like I've been, this whole thing, I don't know, this connection with these kids, like I feel like a little kid again. At 29 years old, I feel like a little kid. You know, I'm thinking my whole life I had it so backwards. As a young kid, I couldn't wait to be an adult. And now that I'm almost 29, I'm not really an adult yet. But as I'm getting an adult, I'm like realizing I'm supposed to be living life like a kid. Everything is so new and so fresh. I do the same thing every single day. Like if someone outside would look at my life and say, man, your life is so boring in that sense that you do the same stuff every day. I do the same stuff every day, but every day it is so new. And I can't explain it unless you've experienced it. It's like having an orange. And I'm up here with this orange and I'm saying, this orange is amazing. And I imagine every single one of you in this room has never experienced an orange before. And imagine I actually was a really good speaker. And I would speak about this orange and I would say, this orange is so cool. And you peel this orange and you eat this orange. This is how it is. And the point of this whole hour talk would be to get you to understand this orange. And you would leave it, maybe some of you would understand it because maybe I could actually speak well to the point that you can intellectually understand it. But the reality is it's not your experience until you do it, until you take that action. If you're in here tonight and you feel that's not your experience, I know there are some people in here who are experiencing that. Grab a hold of them. You do not have to suffer. Suffering is optional. You know? So, thanks for letting me speak.